had been all the men had been talking of. "You know," Mormont grumbled, "how is it that everyone knows everything around here?" He did not seem to expect an answer. "It would seem there were only the two of those creatures, whatever they were. I will not call them men, and thank the gods for that. Any more, and, well, it doesn't bear thinking about. There will be more, though. I can feel it in these old bones of mine, and Maester Aemon agrees. The cold winds are rising. Summer is at an end, and a winter is coming such as this world has never seen." Winter is coming. The stark words had never sounded so grim or ominous to John as they did now. "My lord," he asked hesitantly, "it said there was a bird last night." "There was. What of it?" "I had hoped for some word of my father."
"Father!"
taunted the old raven, bobbing its head as it walked across Mormont's shoulders.
"Father!"
The Lord Commander reached up to pinch his beak shut, but the raven hopped onto his head, fluttered its wings, and flew across the chamber to light above a window. "Grief and noise," Mormont grumbled. "That's all they're good for, ravens. Why I put up with that pestilential bird? If there was news of Lord Eddard, don't you think I would have sent for you? Bastard or no, you're still his blood. The message concerned Sir Barristan Selmy. It seems he's been removed from the King's Guard. They gave his place to that black dog Clegane, and now Selmy's wanted for treason. The fool sent some watchman to seize him, but he slew two of them and escaped." Mormont snorted, leaving no doubt of his view of the men who'd sent gold cloaks against a knight as renowned as Barristan the Bold. "We have white shadows in the woods, an unquiet dead stalking our halls, and a boy sits on the Iron Throne," he said in disgust. The raven laughed shrilly.
"Boy! Boy! Boy! Boy!"
Sir Barristan had been the old bear's best hope, John remembered. If he had fallen, what chance was there that Mormont's letter would be heeded? He curled his hand into a fist. Pain shot through his burned fingers. "What of my sisters?"
"The message made no mention of Lord Eddard or the girls."
He gave an irritated shrug.
"Perhaps they never got my letter. Aemon sent two copies, with his best birds, but who can say? More like Pycelle did not deign to reply. It will not be the first time, nor the last. I fear we count for less than nothing in King's Landing. They tell us what they want us to know, and that's little enough."
"And you tell me what you want me to know, and that's less," John thought resentfully. His brother Rob had called the banners and ridden south to war, yet no word of that had been breathed to him, save by Samwell Tarly, who'd read the letter to Maester Aemon and whispered its contents to John that night in secret, all the time saying how he shouldn't. Doubtless they thought his brother's war was none of his concern. It troubled him more than he could say. Rob was marching, and he was not. No matter how often John told himself that his place was here now, with his new brothers on the wall, he still felt craven.
"Corn!"
the raven was crying.
"Corn! Corn! Oh, be quiet," the old bear told it.
"Snow, how soon does Maester Aemon say you'll have the use of that handbag?" "Soon," John replied.
"Good."
On the table between them, Lord Mormont laid a large sword in a black metal scabbard banded with silver.
"Here, you'll be ready for this, then."
The raven flapped down and landed on the table, strutting towards the sword, head cocked curiously. John hesitated. He had no inkling what this meant.
"My lord?" "The fire melted the silver off the pommel and burnt the cross guard and grip. Well, dry leather and old wood, what can you expect? The blade, now. You'll need a fire 100 times as hot to harm the blade.
Mormont shoved the scabbard across the rough oak planks.
I had the rest made anew. Take it.
Take it,
echoed the raven, preening.
Take it. Take it.
Awkwardly, John took the sword in hand. His left hand, his bandaged right, was still too raw and clumsy. Carefully, he pulled it from its scabbard and raised it level with his eyes. The pommel was a hunk of pale stone weighted with lead to balance the long blade. It had been carved into the likeness of a snarling wolf's head, with chips of garnet set into the eyes. The grip was virgin leather, soft and black, as yet unstained by sweat or blood. The blade itself was a good half foot longer than those John was used to, tapered to thrust as well as slash, with three fullers deeply incised in the metal. Where Ice was a true two-handed greatsword, this was a hand-and-a-halfer, sometimes named a bastard sword. Yet the wolf sword actually seemed lighter than the blades he had wielded before. When John turned it sideways, he could see the ripples in the dark steel where the metal had been folded back on itself again and again. "This is Valyrian steel, my lord," he said wonderingly. His father had let him handle ice often enough. He knew the look, the feel.
"It is," the old bear told him. "It was my father's sword, and his father's before him. The Mormons have carried it for 5 centuries. I wielded it in my day and passed it on to my son when I took the black."
"He is giving me his son's sword?" John could scarcely believe it. The blade was exquisitely balanced. The edges glimmered faintly as they kissed the light. "Your son?"
"My son brought dishonor to House Mormont, but at least he had the grace to leave the sword behind when he fled. My sister returned it to my keeping, but the very sight of it reminded me of Jorah's shame, so I put it aside and thought no more of it until we found it in the ashes of my bedchamber. The original pommel was a bear's head, silver, yet so worn its features were all but indistinguishable. For you, I thought, a white wolf, more apt. One of our builders is a fair stone carver."
When John had been Bran's age, he had dreamed of doing great deeds, as boys always did. The details of his feats changed with every dreaming, but quite often he imagined saving his father's life. Afterward, Lord Eddard would declare that John had proved himself a true Stark and place ice in his hand. Even then, he had known it was only a child's folly. No bastard could ever hope to wield a father's sword. Even the memory shamed him. What kind of man stole his own brother's birthright? "I have no right to this," he thought, "no more than to ice." He twitched his burned fingers, feeling a throb of pain deep under the skin. "My lord, you honour me, but—"
"Spare me your butts, boy," Lord Mormont interrupted. "I would not be sitting here if it were not for you and that beast of yours. You fought bravely, and, more to the point, you thought quickly. Fire! Yes, damn it. We ought to have known. We ought to have remembered. The long night has come before. Oh, 8,000 years is a good while, to be sure. Yet if the Night's Watch does not remember, who will?"
"Who will?"
chimed the talkative raven.
"Who will?"
Truly, the guards had heard John's prayer that night. The fire had caught in the dead man's clothing and consumed him as if his flesh were candle wax and his bones old dry wood. John had only to close his eyes to see the thing staggering across the solar, crashing against the furniture and flailing at the flames. It was a face that haunted him most. Surrounded by a nimbus of fire, hair blazing like straw, the dead flesh melting away and sloughing off its skull to reveal the gleam of bone beneath. Whatever demonic force moved Uther had been driven out by the flames. The twisted thing they had found in the ashes had been no more than cooked meat and charred bone. Yet in his nightmare, he faced it again. And this time, the burning corpse wore Lord Eddard's features. It was his father's skin that burst and blackened, his father's eyes that ran liquid down his cheeks like jellied tears. John did not understand why that should be, or what it might mean, but it frightened him more than he could say. "A sword, small payment for life," Mormont concluded. "Take it! I hear no more of it. Is that understood?" "Yes, my lord." The soft leather gave beneath John's fingers, as if the sword were moulding itself to his grip already. He knew he should be honoured, and he was. And yet, "he is not my father," the thought leapt unbidden to John's mind. "Lord Eddard Stark is my father. I will not forget him, no matter how many swords they give me." Yet he could scarcely tell Lord Mormont that it was another man's sword he dreamt of. "I want no courtesies either," Mormont said. "So thank me no thanks. Honour the steel with deeds, not words." John nodded. "Does it have a name, my lord?" "It did, once. Lungclaw, it was called." "Claw!" the raven cried. "Claw!" "Lungclaw is an apt name." John tried a practice cut. He was clumsy and uncomfortable with his left hand. Yet even so, the steel seemed to flow through the air, as if it had a will of its own. "Wolves have claws as much as bears." The old bear seemed pleased by that. "I suppose they do. You want to wear that over the shoulder, I imagine. It's too long for the hip, at least until you put on a few inches. And you'll need to work at your two-handed strikes as well. Sir Andrew can show you some moves when your burns are healed." "Sir Andrew?" John did not know the name. "Sir Andrew Tarth, a good man. He's on his way from the Shadow Tower to assume the duties of Master-at-Arms. Sir Alistair Thorne left yestermorn for Eastwatch by the sea." John lowered his sword. "Why?" he said stupidly. Mormont snorted. "Because I sent him. Why do you think? He's bringing the hand your ghost tore off the end of Jafer Flower's wrist. I have commanded him to take ship to King's Landing and lay it before this boy king. That should get young Joffrey's attention, I think. And Sir Alistair's a knight, high-born, anointed, with old friends at court, altogether harder to ignore than a glorified crow."
"Crow?"
John thought the raven sounded vaguely indignant. "As well," the Lord Commander continued, ignoring the bird's protest, "it puts 1,000 leagues betwixt him and you without it seeming a rebuke." He jabbed a finger up at John's face. "And don't think this means I approve of that nonsense in the common hall. Valour makes up for a fair amount of folly. But you're not a boy any more, however many years you've seen. That's a man's sword you have there, and it will take a man to wield her. I'll expect you to act the part henceforth."
"Yes, my lord." John slid the sword back into the silver-banded scabbard. If not the blade he would have chosen, it was nonetheless a noble gift, and freeing him from Alistair Thorne's malignance was nobler still. The old bear scratched at his chin.
"I had forgotten how much a new beard itches," he said. "Well, no help for that. Is that hand of yours healed enough to resume your duties?"
"Yes, my lord."
"Good. Well, the night will be cold. I'll want some hot spice wine. Find me a flagon of red, not too sour, and don't skimp on the spices. And tell Hub that if he sends me boiled mutton again, I'm like to boil him. That last haunch was grey. Even the bird wouldn't touch it."
He stroked the raven's head with his thumb, and the bird made a contented quawking sound.
"Away with you. I've work to do."
The guards smiled at him from their niches as he wound his way down the turret stair, carrying the sword in his good hand. Sweet steel, one man said. You've earned that, Snow, another told him.
John made himself smile back at them, but his heart was not in it. He knew he should be pleased, yet he did not feel it. His hand ached, and the taste of anger was in his mouth, though he could not have said who he was angry with or why. A half-dozen of his friends were lurking outside when he left the King's Tower, where Lord Commander Mormont now made his residence. They'd hung a target on the granary doors, so they could seem to be honing their skills as archers, but he knew lurkers when he saw them. No sooner did he emerge than Pip called out,
"Well, come about. Let's have a look."
"At what?" John said. Toad sidled close.
"Your rosy butt cheeks, what else?"
"The sword," Gren stated. "We want to see the sword."
John raked them with an accusing look.
"You knew."
Pip grinned.
"We're not all as dumb as Gren." "You are so," insisted Gren. "You're dumber."
Holder gave an apologetic shrug.
"I helped Pate carve the stone for the pommel," the builder said, "and your friend Sam bought the garnets in Molestown."
"We knew even before that, though," Gren said. "Rudge had been helping Donal Noy in the forge. Oh, he was there when the old bear brought him the burnt blade."
"The sword,"
Matt insisted. The others took up the chant.
"The sword! The sword! The sword!"
John unsheathed Longclaw and showed it to them, turning it this way and that so they could admire it. The bastard blade glittered in the pale sunlight, dark and deadly. "Valyrian steel," he declared solemnly, trying to sound as if pleased and proud as he ought to have felt. "I heard of a man who had a razor made of Valyrian steel," declared Toad.
"He cut his head off trying to shave."
Pip grinned.
"The Night's Watch is thousands of years old," he said, "but I'll wager Lord Snow's the first brother ever honoured for burning down the Lord Commander's tower."
The others laughed, and even John had to smile. The fire had started had not, in truth, burned down that formidable stone tower, but it had done a fair job of gutting the interior of the top two floors, where the old bear had his chambers. No one seemed to mind that very much, since it had also destroyed Uther's murderous corpse. The other wight, the one-handed thing that had once been a ranger named Jafer Flowers, had also been destroyed, cut near to pieces by a dozen swords, but not before it had slain Sir Jeremy Riker and four other men. Sir Jeremy had finished the job of hacking its head off, yet had died all the same when the headless corpse pulled his own dagger from its sheath and buried it in his bowels. Strength and courage did not avail much against foemen who would not fall because they were already dead. Even arms and armour offered small protection. That grim thought soured John's fragile mood.
"I need to see Hub about the old bear's supper," he announced brusquely, sliding Longclaw back into its scabbard.
His friends meant well, but they did not understand. It was not their fault, truly. They had not had to face Uther. They had not seen the pale glow of those dead blue eyes, had not felt the cold of those dead black fingers. Nor did they know of the fighting in the Riverlands. How could they hope to comprehend? He turned away from them abruptly and strode off, sullen. Pip called after him, but John paid him no mind. They had moved him back to his old cell in tumble-down Harden's Tower after the fire, and it was there he returned. Ghost was curled up asleep beside the door, but he lifted his head at the sound of John's boots. The direwolf's red eyes were darker than garnets and wiser than men. John knelt, scratched his ear, and showed him the pommel of his sword.
"Look, it's you."
Ghost sniffed at his carved stone likeness and tried a lick. John smiled. "You're the one deserves an honour," he told the wolf, and suddenly he found himself remembering how he'd found him, that day in the late summer snow. They'd been riding off with the other pups, but John had heard a noise and turned back, and there he was, white fur almost invisible against the drifts. He was all alone, he thought, apart from the others in the litter. He was different, so they drove him out.
John!
He looked up. Samuel Tarley stood rocking nervously on his heels. His cheeks were red, and he was wrapped in a heavy fur cloak that made him look ready for hibernation.
Sam! John stood. What is it?
Do you want to see the sword? If the others had known, no doubt Sam did too. The fat boy shook his head.
I was heir to my father's blade once, he said mournfully. Heartsbane. Lord Randall let me hold it a few times, but it always scared me. It was Valyrian steel, beautiful but so sharp I was afraid I'd hurt one of my sisters. Dickon will have it now.
He wiped sweaty hands on his cloak.
Maester Aemon wants to see you.
It was not time for his bandages to be changed. John frowned suspiciously. Why? He demanded. Sam looked miserable. That was answer enough.
You told him, didn't you? John said angrily. You told him that you told me. I didn't want to. He asked, I mean, I think he knew. He sees things no one else sees.
He's blind, John pointed out forcefully, disgusted. I can find a way myself. He left Sam standing there, open-mouthed and quivering. He found Maester Aemon up in the rookery, feeding the ravens. Clydus was with him, carrying a bucket of chopped meat as they shuffled from cage to cage. Sam said you wanted me. The maester nodded.
I did, indeed. Clydus, give John the bucket. Perhaps he will be kind enough to assist me.
The hunched, pink-eyed brother handed John the bucket and scurried down the ladder.
Toss the meat into the cages, Aemon instructed him. The birds will do the rest.
John shifted the bucket to his right hand and thrust his left down into the bloody bits. The ravens began to scream noisily and fly at the bars, beating at the metal with night-black wings. The meat had been chopped into pieces no larger than a finger joint. He lifted his fist and tossed the raw red morsels into the cage, and the squawking and squabbling grew hotter. Feathers flew as two of the larger birds fought over a choice piece. Quickly, John grabbed a second handful and threw it in after the first. Lord Mormont's raven likes fruit and corn.
He is a rare bird, the maester said. Most ravens will eat grain, but they prefer flesh. It makes them strong, and I fear they relish the taste of blood, in that they are like men, and like men, not all ravens are alike.
John had nothing to say to that. He threw meat, wondering why he'd been summoned. No doubt the old man would tell him, in his own good time. Maester Aemon was not a man to be hurried.
Doves and pigeons can also be trained to carry messages, the maester went on. Though the raven is a stronger flyer, larger, bolder, far more clever, better able to defend itself against hawks. Yet ravens are black, and they eat the dead, so some godly men abhor them. Balor the Blessed tried to replace all the ravens with doves. Did you know?
The maester turned his white eyes on John, smiling.
The Night's Watch prefers ravens.
John's fingers were in the bucket, blood up to his wrist. Dywin says the wildlings call us crows, he said uncertainly.
The crow is a raven's poor cousin. They are both beggars in black, hated and misunderstood.
John wished he understood what they were talking about, and why. What did he care about ravens and doves? If the old man had something to say to him, why couldn't he just say it?
John, did you ever wonder why the men of the Night's Watch take no wives and father no children?
Maester Aemon asked. John shrugged.
No.
He scattered more meat. The fingers of his left hand were slimy with blood, and his right throbbed from the weight of the bucket.
So they will not love,
the old man answered,
for love is the bane of honour, the death of duty.
That did not sound right to John, yet he said nothing. The maester was 100 years old, and a high officer of the Night's Watch. It was not his place to contradict him. The old man seemed to sense his doubts.
Tell me, John, if the day should ever come when your lord father must needs choose between honour on the one hand and those he loves on the other, what would he do?
John hesitated. He wanted to say that Lord Eddard would never dishonour himself, not even for love. Yet inside a small, sly voice whispered, "He fathered a bastard. Where was the honour in that? And your mother? What of his duty to her? He will not even say her name." "He would do whatever was right," he said ringingly, to make up for his hesitation. "No matter what."
"Then Lord Eddard is a man in 10,000. Most of us are not so strong. What is honour compared to a woman's love? What is duty against the feel of a newborn son in your arms, or the memory of a brother's smile? Wind and words, wind and words. We are only human, and the gods have fashioned us for love. That is our great glory and our great tragedy. The men who formed the Night's Watch knew that only their courage shielded the realm from the darkness to the north. They knew they must have no divided loyalties to weaken their resolve. So they vowed they would have no wives nor children. Yet, brothers, they had, and sisters, mothers who gave them birth, fathers who gave them names. They came from 100 quarrelsome kingdoms, and they knew times may change, but men do not. So they pledged as well that the Night's Watch would take no part in the battles of the realms it guarded. They kept their pledge. When Aegon slew Black Heron and claimed his kingdom, Heron's brother was Lord Commander on the Wall, with 10,000 swords to hand. He did not march. In the days when the Seven Kingdoms were Seven Kingdoms, not a generation passed that 3 or 4 of them were not at war. The Watch took no part. When the Andals crossed the narrow sea and swept away the kingdoms of the first men, the sons of the fallen kings held true to their vows and remained at their posts. So it has always been, for years beyond counting. Such is the price of honour. A craven can be as brave as any man, when there is nothing to fear, and we all do our duty, when there is no cost to it. How easy it seems then to walk the path of honour. Yet soon or late, in every man's life, comes a day when it is not easy, a day when he must choose.
Some of the ravens were still eating long, stringy bits of meat dangling from their beaks. The rest seemed to be watching him. John could feel the weight of all those tiny black eyes. "And this is my day? Is that what you're saying?" Maester Aemon turned his head and looked at him with those dead white eyes. It was as if he were seeing right into his heart. John felt naked and exposed. He took the bucket in both hands and flung the rest of the slops through the bars. Strings of meat and blood flew everywhere, scattering the ravens. They took to the air, shrieking wildly. The quicker birds snatched morsels on the wing and gulped them down greedily. John let the empty bucket clang to the floor. The old man laid a withered, spotted hand on his shoulder.
"It hurts, boy," he said softly. "Oh, yes, choosing. It has always hurt, and always will. I know."
"You don't know," John said bitterly. "No one knows. Even if I am his bastard, he's still my father." Maester Aemon sighed.
"Have you heard nothing I've told you, John? Do you think you are the first?"
He shook his ancient head, a gesture weary beyond words.
"Three times the gods saw fit to test my vows. Once when I was a boy, once in the fullness of my manhood, and once when I had grown old. By then my strength was fled, my eyes grown dim. Yet that last choice was as cruel as the first. My ravens would bring the news from the south, words darker than their wings. The ruin of my house, the death of my kin, disgrace and desolation. What could I have done? Old, blind, frail, I was helpless as a suckling babe, yet still it grieved me to sit forgotten as they cut down my brother's poor grandson and his son, and even the little children."
John was shocked to see the shine of tears in the old man's eyes. "Who are you?" he asked quietly, almost in dread. A toothless smile quivered on the ancient's lips.
"Only a maester of the citadel, bound in service to Castle Black and the Night's Watch. In my order, we put aside our house names when we take our vows and don the collar."
The old man touched the maester's chain that hung loosely around his thin, fleshless neck.
"My father was Maekar, the first of his name, and my brother Aegon reigned after him in my stead. My grandfather named me for Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, who was his uncle, or his father, depending on which tale you believe. Aemon, he called me."
"Aemon? Targaryen?" John could scarcely believe it.
"Once," the old man said, "once. So you see, John, I do know, and knowing, I will not tell you stay or go. You must make that choice yourself and live with it all the rest of your days. As I have," his voice fell to a whisper, "as I have."
Sansa. The torches shimmered brightly against the hammered metal of the wall sconces, filling the Queen's ballroom with silvery light. Yet there was still darkness in that hall. Sansa could see it in the pale eyes of Sir Ilyen Payne. who stood by the back door, still as stone, taking neither food nor wine. She could hear it in Lord Giles' racking cough, and the whispered voice of Osney Kettleblack when he slipped in to bring Cersei the tidings. Sansa was finishing her broth when he came the first time, entering through the back. She glimpsed him talking to his brother, Osfrid. Then he climbed the dais and knelt beside the high seat, smelling of horse. Four long, thin scratches on his cheek crusted with scabs, his hair falling down past his collar and into his eyes. For all his whispering, Sansa could not help but hear.
"The fleets are locked in battle. Some archers got ashore, but the hounds cut them to pieces, Your Grace. Your brother's raising his chain. I heard the signal. Some drunkards, down to Flea Bottom, are smashing doors and climbing through windows. Lord Bywater sent the gold cloaks to deal with them. Baelor Sept is jam full. Everyone praying."
"And my son?"
"The king went to Baelor's to get the High Septon's blessing. Now he's walking the walls with a hand, telling the men to be brave, lifting their spirits, as it were."
Cersei beckoned to her page for another cup of wine, a golden vintage from the arbour, fruity and rich. The queen was drinking heavily, but the wine only seemed to make her more beautiful. Her cheeks were flushed, and her eyes had a bright, feverish heat to them, as she looked down over the hall. "Eyes of wildfire," Sansa thought. Musicians played, jugglers juggled. Moonboy lurched about the hall on stilts, making mock of everyone, while Ser Dontus chased serving girls on his broomstick horse. The guests laughed, but it was a joyless laughter, the sort of laughter that can turn into sobbing in half a heartbeat. Their bodies are here, but their thoughts are on the city walls, and their hearts as well. After the broth came a salad of apples, nuts, and raisins. At any other time, it might have made a tasty dish, but tonight all the food was flavoured with fear. Sansa was not the only one in the hall without an appetite. Lord Giles was coughing more than he was eating. Lolly Stokeworth sat hunched and shivering, and the young bride of one of Sir Lancel's knights began to weep uncontrollably. The queen commanded Maester Franken to put her to bed with a cup of dream wine. "Tears," she said scornfully to Sansa, as the woman was led from the hall. "The woman's weapon, my lady mother used to call them. The man's weapon is a sword. And that tells us all you need to know, doesn't it?" "Men must be very brave, though," said Sansa, "to ride out and face swords and axes, everyone trying to kill you. Jaime told me once that he only feels truly alive in battle and in bed." She lifted her cup and took a long swallow. Her salad was untouched. "I would sooner face any number of swords than sit helpless like this, pretending to enjoy the company of this flock of frightened hens." "You ask them here, Your Grace." "Certain things are expected of a queen. They will be expected of you, should you ever wed Joffrey. Best learn." The queen studied the wives, daughters, and mothers who filled the benches. "Of themselves, the hens are nothing. But their cocks are important for one reason or another, and some may survive this battle. So it behooves me to give their women my protection. If my wretched dwarf of a brother should somehow manage to prevail, they will return to their husbands and fathers full of tales about how brave I was, how my courage inspired them and lifted their spirits, how I never doubted our victory even for a moment. And if the castle should fall?" "You'd like that, wouldn't you?" Cersei did not wait for a denial. "If I'm not betrayed by my own guards, I may be able to hold here for a time. Then I can go to the walls and offer to yield to Lord Stannis in person. That will spare us the worst. But if Maegor's holdfast should fall before Stannis can come up, why then most of my guests are in for a bit of rape, I'd say. And you should never rule out mutilation, torture, and murder at times like this." Sansa was horrified. "These are women, unarmed and gently born." "Their birth protects them," Cersei admitted, "though not as much as you'd think. Each one's worth a good ransom. But after the madness of battle, soldiers seem to want flesh more than coin. Even so, a golden shield is better than none. Out in the streets, the women won't be treated near as tenderly, nor will our servants. Pretty things like that serving wench of Lady Tander's could be in for a lively night. But don't imagine the old and the infirm and the ugly will be spared. Enough drink will make blind washerwomen and reeking pig girls seem as comely as you, sweetling. Me? Try not to sound so like a mouse, Sansa. You're a woman now, remember? And betrothed to my firstborn. The queen sipped at her wine. Were it anyone else outside the gates, I might hope to beguile him. But this is Stannis Baratheon. I'd have a better chance of seducing his horse. She noticed the look on Sansa's face and laughed. Have I shocked you, my lady? She leaned close. You little fool. Tears are not a woman's only weapon. You've got another one between your legs, and you'd best learn to use it. You'll find men use their swords freely enough. Both kinds of swords. Sansa was spared the need to reply when two kettleblacks re-entered the hall. Sir Osmond and his brothers had become great favourites about the castle. They were always ready with a smile and a jest. They got on with grooms and huntsmen, as well as they did with knights and squires. With the serving wenches, they got on best of all. It was gossiped. Of late, Sir Osmond had taken Sandor Clegane's place by Joffrey's side, and Sansa had heard the women at the washing well saying he was as strong as a hound, only younger and faster. If that were so, she wondered why she had never once heard of these kettleblacks before Sir Osmond was named to the King's Guard. Osney was all smiles as he knelt beside the Queen. The hulks have gone up, Your Grace. The whole Blackwater awash with wildfire. 100 ships burning, maybe more. And my son? He's at the Mudgate, with the Hand and the King's Guard, Your Grace. He spoke to the archers on the hoardings before and gave them a few tips on handling a crossbow he did. All agree he's a right brave boy. He'd best remain a right live boy. Cersei turned to his brother Osfrid, who was taller, sterner, and wore a drooping black moustache. Yes? Osfrid had donned a steel half-helm over his long black hair, and the look on his face was grim. Your Grace, he said quietly. The boys caught a groom and two maidservants trying to sneak out a postern with three of the king's horses. The knight's first traitors, the queen said, but not the last, I fear. Have Sir Ilion see to them and put their heads on pikes outside the stables as a warning. As they left, she turned to Sansa. Another lesson you should learn, if you hope to sit beside my son. Be gentle on a night like this, and you'll have treasons popping up all around you like mushrooms after a hard rain. The only way to keep your people loyal is to make certain they fear you more than they do the enemy. I will remember, Your Grace, said Sansa, though she had always heard that love was a surer route to the people's loyalty than fear. If I'm ever a queen, I will make them love me. Crab claw pies followed the salad. Then came mutton, roasted with leeks and carrots, served in trenchers of hollowed bread. Lollies ate too fast, got sick, and retched all over herself and her sister. Lord Giles coughed, drank, and passed out. The queen gazed down in disgust to where he sprawled with his face in his trencher and his hand in a puddle of wine. The guards must have been mad to waste manhood on the likes of him, and I must have been mad to demand his release. Osfrid Kettleblack returned, crimson cloak swirling. There's folks gathered in the square, Your Grace, asking to take refuge in the castle. Not a mob, rich merchants and the like. Command them to return to their homes, the Queen said. If they won't go, have our crossbowmen kill a few. No sorties. I won't have the gates open for any reason. As you command. He bowed and moved off. The Queen's face was hard and angry. Would that I could take a sword to their necks myself. Her voice was starting to slur. When we were little, Jaime and I were so much alike that even our Lord Father could not tell us apart.
Sometimes, as a lark, we would dress in each other's clothes and spend a whole day each as the other. Yet even so, when Jamie was given his first sword, there was none for me. "What do I get?" I remember asking. We were so much alike. I can never understand why they treated us differently. Jamie learned to fight with sword and lance and mace, while I was taught to smile and sing and please. He was heir to Castle Rock, while I was to be sold to some stranger like a horse, to be ridden whenever my new owner liked, beaten whenever he liked, and cast aside in time for a younger filly. Jamie's lot was to be glory and power, while mine was birth and moonblood.
"But you were queen of all the seven kingdoms," Sansa said.
"When it comes to swords, a queen is only a woman after all."
Cersei's wine cup was empty. The page moved to fill it up again, but she turned it over and shook her head.
"No more. I must keep a clear head."
The last course was goat cheese served with baked apples. The scent of cinnamon filled the hall as Osney Kettleblack slipped in to kneel once more between them.
"Your Grace," he murmured, "Stannis has landed men on the tawny grounds, and there's more coming across. The Mudgate's under attack, and they brought a ram to the King's Gate. The imp's gone out to drive them off."
"Well, that will fill them with fear,"
the Queen said dryly. "He hasn't taken Joff, I hope."
"No, Your Grace. The King's with my brother at the Hawes, flinging antler men into the river."
"With the Mudgate under assault? Folly. Tell Sir Osmond I want him out of there at once. It's too dangerous. Fetch him back to the castle."
The imp said, "It's what I say that ought to concern you."
Cersei's eyes narrowed.
"Your brother will do as he's told, or I'll see to it that he leads the next sortie himself, and you'll go with him."
After the meal had been cleared away, many of the guests asked leave to go to the Sept. Cersei graciously granted their request. Lady Tanda and her daughters were among those who fled. For those who remained, a singer was brought forth to fill the hall with the sweet music of the high harp. He sang of Jonquil and Florian, of Prince Aemon the Dragon Knight, and his love for his brother's queen, of Nymeria's 10,000 ships. They were beautiful songs, but terribly sad. Several of the women began to weep, and Sansa felt her own eyes growing moist.
"Very good, dear," the Queen leaned closer. "You want to practice those tears. You'll need them for King Stannis."
Sansa shifted nervously.
"Your Grace?"
"Oh, spare me your hollow courtesies. Matters must have reached a desperate strait out there if they need a dwarf to lead them, so you might as well take off your mask. I know all about your little treasons in the Godswood."
"The Godswood?
Don't look as Sedontas, don't, Sansa told herself. "She doesn't know, no one knows. Dontas promised me. My Florian would never fail me."
"I've done no treasons. I only visit the Guardswood to pray."
"For Stannis? Or your brother? It's all the same. Why else seek your father's gods? You're praying for our defeat. What would you call that, if not treason?"
"I pray for Joffrey," she insisted nervously.
"Why? Because he treats you so sweetly."
The Queen took a flagon of sweet plum wine from a passing serving girl and filled Sansa's cup.
"Drink," she commanded coldly. "Perhaps it will give you the courage to deal with truth for a change."
Sansa lifted the cup to her lips and took a sip. The wine was cloyingly sweet, but very strong.
"You can do better than that," Cersei said. "Drain the cup, Sansa. Your queen commands it."
It almost gagged her, but Sansa emptied the cup, gulping down the thick, sweet wine until her head was swimming.
"More?"
Cersei asked.
"No, please."
The queen looked displeased.
"When you asked about Sir Ilion earlier, I lied to you. Would you like to hear the truth, Sansa? Would you like to know why he's really here?"
She did not dare answer, but it did not matter. The queen raised a hand and beckoned, never waiting for a reply. Sansa had not even seen Sir Ilion return to the hall, but suddenly there he was, striding from the shadows behind the dais as silent as a cat. He carried ice, unsheathed. Her father had always cleaned the blade in the guardswood after he took a man's head, Sansa recalled. But Sir Ilion was not so fastidious. There was blood drying on the rippling steel, the red already fading to brown.
"Tell Lady Sansa why I keep you by us," said Cersei.
Sir Ilion opened his mouth and emitted a choking rattle. His puck-scarred face had no expression. "He's here for us, he says," the queen said. "Stannis may take the city, and he may take the throne. But I will not suffer him to judge me. I do not mean for him to have us alive."
"Us?"
"You heard me. So perhaps you had best pray again, Sansa, and for a different outcome. The Starks will have no joy from the fall of House Lannister, I promise you." She reached out and touched Sansa's hair, brushing it lightly away from her neck. The Spurned Suitor. The hour of ghosts was almost upon them when Sir Gaerys Drinkwater returned to the pyramid to report that he had found beans, books, and old Bill Bone in one of Meereen's less savoury cellars, drinking yellow wine and watching naked slaves kill one another with bare hands and filed teeth. Beans pulled a blade and proposed a wager to determine if deserters had bellies full of yellow slime, Sir Gaerys reported. "So I tossed him a dragon and asked if yellow gold would do. He bit the coin and asked what I meant to buy. When I told him, he slipped the knife away and asked if I was drunk or mad. Let him think what he wants, so long as he delivers the message," said Quentin. "He'll do that much. I'll wager you get your meat in, too. If only so rags can have pretty merits, cut your liver out and fry it up with onions. We should be heeding Selmy. When Barristan the Bold tells you to run, a wise man laces up his boots. We should find a ship for Volantis whilst the port is still open." Just the mention turned Sir Archibald's cheeks green. "No more ships? I'd sooner up back to Volantis on one foot." "Volantis," Quentin thought. "Then Lys, then home. Back the way I came, empty-handed. Three brave men dead. For what?" It would be sweet to see the green blood again, to visit Sunspear and the water gardens and breathe the clean, sweet mountain air of Ironwood, in place of the hot, wet, filthy humours of Slaver's Bay. His father would speak no word of rebuke, Quentin knew, but the disappointment would be there in his eyes. His sister would be scornful. The Sand Snakes would mock him with smiles sharp as swords. And Lord Arnwood, his second father, who had sent his own son along to keep him safe? "I will not keep you here," Quentin told his friends. "My father laid this task on me, not you. Go home, if that's what you want. By whatever means you like, I am staying." The big man shrugged. "Then Drink and me are staying too." The next night, Denzo Dan turned up at Prince Quentin's door to talk terms. "He will meet with you on the morrow, by the spice market. Look for a door marked with a purple lotus. Knock twice and call for freedom." "Agreed," said Quentin. "Arch and Gaerys will be with me. He can bring two men as well. No more." "If it please my prince." The words were polite enough, but Denzo's tone was edged with malice, and the eyes of the warrior poet gleamed bright with mockery. "Come at sunset, and see that you are not followed." The Dornishmen left the Great Pyramid an hour shy of sunset, in case they took a wrong turn or had difficulty finding the purple lotus. Quentin and Gaerys wore their sword belts. The big man had his war hammer
slung across his broad back. "It is still not too late to abandon this folly," Gareth said, as they made their way down a fetid alley toward the Old Spice Market. The smell of piss was in the air, and they could hear the rumble of a corpse cart's iron-rimmed wheels off ahead. Old Bill Bone used to say that Pretty Maris could stretch out a man's dying for a moon's turn. We lied to them, Quent, used them to get us here, then went over to the Stormcrows, as we were commanded.
"Tatters never meant for us to do it for real, though," put in the big man. "His other boys, Sir Orson and Dick Straw, Ungerford, Will of the Woods, that lot. They're still down in some dungeon, thanks to us. Old Rags can't have liked that much."
"No," Prince Quentin said, "but he likes gold." Gareth laughed. "A pity we have none. Do you trust this priest, Quent?"
"I don't.
Half the city is calling the Dragon Slayer a hero, and the other half spits blood at the mention of his name."
"Harzoo,"
the big man said. Quentin frowned. "His name was Hargaz."
"His dar humzum hagnag. What's it matter? I called them all Harzoo. He was no Dragon Slayer. All he did was get his arse roasted, black and crispy."
"He was brave. Would I have the courage to face that monster with nothing but a spear?"
"He died bravely, is what you mean." "He died screaming," said Arch.
Gareth put a hand on Quentin's shoulder. "Even if the Queen returns, she'll still be married."
"Not if I give King Harzoo a little smack with my hammer," suggested the big man.
"Hisdar," said Quentin. "His name is Hisdar.
One kiss from my hammer, and no one will care what his name was," said Arch.
They do not see. His friends had lost sight of his true purpose here.
"The road leads through her, not to her. Daenerys is the means to the prize, not the prize itself."
"The dragon has three heads," she said to me. "My marriage need not be the end of all your hopes," she said.
"I know why you're here. For fire and blood."
"I have Targaryen blood in me. You know that. I can trace my lineage back." "Fuck your lineage," said Gareth. "The dragons won't care about your blood, except maybe how it tastes. You cannot tame a dragon with a history lesson. They're monsters, not maesters. Quint, is this truly what you want to do?"
"This is what I have to do. For Dorne. For my father. For Cletus and Will and Maester Kedri."
"They're dead," said Gareth. "They won't care."
"All dead," Quentin agreed.
"For what?"
"To bring me here so I might wed the Dragon Queen. A grand adventure, Cletus called it. Demon roads and stormy seas, and at the end of it, the most beautiful woman in the world. A tale to tell our grandchildren. But Cletus will never father a child, unless he left a bastard in the belly of that tavern wench he liked. Will will never have his wedding. Their deaths should have some meaning."
Gareth pointed to where a corpse slumped against a brick wall, attended by a cloud of glistening green flies.
"Did his death have meaning?"
Quentin looked at the body with distaste.
"He died of the flux. Stay well away from him."
The pale mare was inside the city walls. Small wonder that the streets seemed so empty.
"The Unsullied will send a corpse cart for him."
"No doubt. But that was not my question. Men's lives have meaning, not their deaths. I loved Will, and Cletus too. But this will not bring them back to us.
This is a mistake, Quent. You cannot trust in sellswords.
They are men like any other men. They want gold, glory, power. That's all I'm trusting in. That and my own destiny. I'm a prince of Dawn, and the blood of dragons is in my veins." The sun had sunk below the city wall by the time they found the Purple Lotus. Painted on the weather wooden door of a low brick hovel, squatting amidst a row of similar hovels, in the shadow of the great yellow and green pyramid.